I lied to you. I said at the beginning of this narrative that I was not with her when Aeneas' fate was played out, implying that I did not know what that fate might be. And I repeated it some sleep periods ago, when I scribed what I was sure must be the last installment of that same narrative. But I lied by omission, as some priest of the church might say. I lied because I did not want to discuss it, to describe it, to relive it, to believe it. But I know now that I must do all of these things. I have relived it every hour of my incarceration here in this Schrödinger cat box prison. I have believed it since the moment I shared the experience with my dear friend, my dear Aeneas. I knew before they shipped me out of Pacham's system what the fate of my dear girl had been. Having believed it and relived it, I owe it to the truth of this narrative and to the memory of our love to discuss it and describe it. All this came to me while I was drugged and docile, tethered in a high-G tank aboard the robot shuttle an hour after my 10-minute trial in front of the Inquisition on a Pax Base asteroid 10 light-minutes from Pacham. I knew as soon as I heard and felt and saw these things that they were real, that they were happening at the moment I shared them, and that only my closeness to Aeneas and my slow progress in learning the language of the living had allowed such a powerful sharing. When the sharing was over, I began screaming in my high-G tank, ripping at life-support umbilicals and banging the bulkhead with my head and fists until the water-filled tank was swirling with my blood. I tried tearing at the osmosis mask that covered my face like some parasite sucking away my breath. It would not tear. For a full 3 hours I screamed and protested, battering myself into a state of semi-consciousness at best, reliving the shared moments with Aeneas 1,000 times and screaming in agony 1,000 times. And then the robot ship injected sleep drugs through the leech-like umbilicals, the high-G tank drained, and I drifted away into cryogenic fugue as the torch ship reached the translation point for the jump to nearby Armagast system. I awoke in the Schrödinger cat box. The robot ship had loaded me into the fused energy satellite and launched it without human intervention. For a few moments I was disoriented, believing that the shared moments with Aeneas had all been nightmare. Then the reality of those moments flooded back, and I began screaming again. I believe that I was not sane again for some months. Here is what drove me to madness. Aeneas had also been taken, bleeding and unconscious, from St. Peter's Basilica. But unlike me, she awoke the next day neither drugged nor shunted. She came to consciousness, and I shared this awakening more clearly than I have recalled any memory of mine, as sharp and real as a second set of sense impressions. In a huge stone room, round, some 30 meters across, with a ceiling 50 meters above the stone floor. Set in the ceiling was a glowing frosted glass that gave the sense of a skylight, although Aeneas guessed that this was an illusion and that the room was deep within a larger structure. The medics had cleaned me up for my 10-minute trial while I was unconscious, but no one had touched Aeneas' wounds. The left side of her face was tender, swollen with bruises. Her clothes had been torn away from her body and she was naked. Her lips were swollen, her left eye was almost shut. She could see out of it only with effort, and the vision from her right eye was blurred from concussion. And there were cuts and bruises on her chest, thighs, forearm, and belly. Some of these cuts had caked over, but a few were deep enough to require stitches that no one had provided. They still bled. She was strapped in what appeared to be a rusted iron skeleton of crossed metal that hung by chains from the high ceiling, and that allowed her to lean back and rest her weight against it, but still kept her almost standing. Her arms held low along the rusted girders. A near-vertical asterisk of cold metal hanging in air, with her wrists and ankles cruelly clamped and bolted to the frame. Her toes hung about 10 centimeters above a grated floor. She could move her head. The round room was empty, except for this and 2 other objects. A broad wastebasket sat to the right of the chair. There was a plastic liner in the wastebasket. Also, next to the right arm of the asterisk, was a rusted metal tray with various instruments on it. Ancient dental picks and pliers, circular blades, scalpels, bone saws, a long forceps of some kind, pieces of wire with barbs at 3-centimeter intervals, long-bladed shears, shorter, serrated shears, bottles of dark fluid, tubes of paste, needles, heavy thread, and a hammer. Even more disturbing was the round grate some 2.5 meters across beneath her, through which she could see dozens of tiny blue flames burning like pilot lights. There was the faint smell of natural gas. Aeneas tried the restraints. They gave not at all. Felt her bruised wrists and ankles throb at the attempts, and put her head back against the iron girder to wait. Her hair was matted there, and she could feel a huge lump high on her scalp and another near the base of her skull. She felt nauseous and concentrated on not throwing up on herself. After a few minutes, a hidden door in the stone wall opened, and Radamanth Nemes came in and walked to a place just beyond the grate to the right side of Aeneas. A second Radamanth Nemes came in and took her place on Aeneas' left side. 2 more Nemeses came in and took up positions farther back. They did not speak. Aeneas did not speak to them. A few minutes later, John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa shimmered into existence, his life-size holographic image taking on solidity directly in front of Aeneas. The illusion of his physical presence was perfect, except for the fact that the cardinal was sitting on a chair not represented in the hologram, giving the illusion that he was floating in midair. Mustafa looked younger and healthier than he had on Tian Shan. A few seconds later, he was joined by the hollow of a more massive cardinal in a red robe, and then by the hollow of a thin, tubercular-looking priest. A moment after that, a tall, handsome man, dressed all in gray, came through the physical door in the wall of the physical dungeon and stood with the hollows. Mustafa and the other cardinal continued sitting on unseen chairs, while the Monsignor's hollow and the physically present man in gray stood behind the chairs like servants. "Aeneas," said the Grand Inquisitor, "allow me to introduce the Vatican Secretary of State, His Eminence Cardinal Lourdesami, his aide Monsignor Lucas Oddi, and our esteemed Counselor Albedo." "Where am I?" asked Aeneas. She had to attempt the sentence a second time because of her swollen lips and bruised jaw. The Grand Inquisitor smiled. "We will answer all of your questions for the moment, my dear, and then you will answer all of ours. I guarantee this. To answer your first question, you are in the deepest, interview room in the Castel Sant'Angelo, on the right bank of the new Tiber, near the Ponte Sant'Angelo, quite near the Vatican, still on the world of Pacem."
"Where is Rawl?"
"Rawl?" said the Grand Inquisitor. "Oh, you mean your rather useless bodyguard. At the moment, I believe he has completed his own meeting with the Holy Office, and is aboard a ship preparing to leave our fair system. Is he important to you, my dear? We could make arrangements to return him to Castel Sant'Angelo."
"He's not important," murmured Aeneas.
And after my first second of hurt and anguish at the words, I could feel her thoughts beneath them. Concern for me, terror for me, hope that they would not threaten me as a means to coerce her. "As you wish," said Cardinal Mustafa. "It is you we want to interview today. How do you feel?"
Aeneas stared at them through her good eye.
"Well," said the Grand Inquisitor, "one should not hope to attack the Holy Father in St. Peter's Basilica and come away with impunity."
Aeneas mumbled something.
"What was that, my dear? We could not make it out." Mustafa was smiling slightly, a toad's self-satisfied leer.
"I did not attack the Pope." Mustafa opened his hands.
"If you insist, Aeneas. But your intentions did not seem friendly. What is it that you had in mind as you ran down the central aisle toward the Holy Father?"
Warn him, said Aenea. Part of her mind was assessing her injuries, even as she listened to the Grand Inquisitor's prattle. Serious bruises, but nothing broken. The sword cut on her thigh needed stitching, as did the cut on her upper chest. But something was wrong in her system. Internal bleeding? She did not think so. Something alien had been administered to her via injection.
Warn him of what? Said Cardinal Mustafa with butter smoothness.
Aenea moved her head to look with her good eye at Cardinal Lourdesami and then at Counselor Albedo. She said nothing.
Warn him of what?
Asked Cardinal Mustafa again. When Aenea did not respond, the Grand Inquisitor nodded to the nearest Nemez clone. The pale woman walked slowly to the side of Aenea's chair, took up the smaller of the two shears, seemed to think twice about it, set the instrument back on the tray, came closer, went to one knee on the grate next to Aenea's right arm, bent back my darling's little finger, and bit it off. Nemez smiled, stood, and spit the bloody finger into the wastebasket. Aenea screamed with the shock and pain and half-swooned against the headrest. The Nemez thing took tourniquet paste from the tube and smeared it on the stump of Aenea's little finger. The hollow of Cardinal Mustafa looked sad.
We do not desire to administer pain, my dear, but we also shall not hesitate to do so. You shall answer our questions quickly and honestly, or more parts of you will end up in the basket. Your tongue will be the last to go.
Aenea fought back the nausea. The pain from her mutilated hand was incredible. 10 light minutes away, I screamed with the second-hand shock of it.
I was going to warn the Pope about your coup, gasped Aenea, still looking at Lourdesami and Albedo. Heart attack.
Cardinal Mustafa blinked in surprise.
You are a witch, he said softly.
And you're a traitorous asshole, Aenea said strongly and clearly. All of you are. You sold out your church, now you're selling out your puppet, Lenar Hoyt.
Oh?
Said Cardinal Lourdesami. He looked mildly amused.
How are we doing that, child?
Aenea jerked her head at Counselor Albedo.
The Corps controls everyone's life and death via the cruciforms. People die when it's convenient for the Corps to have them dead. Neural networks in the process of dying are more creative than living ones. You're going to kill the Pope again, but this time his resurrection won't be successful, will it?
Very perceptive, my dear,
rumbled Cardinal Lourdesami. He shrugged.
Perhaps it is time for a new pontiff.
He moved his hand in the air, and a fifth hologram appeared behind them in the room. Pope Urban XVI, comatose in a hospital bed, nursing nuns, human doctors, and medical machines hovering around him. Lourdesami waved his pudgy hand again, and the image disappeared.
Your turn to be Pope?
Said Aenea and closed her eyes. Red spots were dancing in her vision. When she opened her eyes again, Lourdesami was making a modest shrug.
Enough of this, said Counselor Albedo.
He walked directly through the hollows of the seated cardinals and stood at the edge of the grate, directly in front of Aenea.
How have you been manipulating the Farcaster medium? How do you Farcast without the portals?
Aenea looked at the Corps representative.
It scares you, doesn't it, Counselor? In the same way that the cardinals are too frightened to be here with me in person.
The gray man showed his perfect teeth.
Not at all, Aenea. But you have the ability to Farcast yourself, and those near you, without portals. His Eminence Cardinal Lourdesami and Cardinal Mustafa, as well as Monsignor Odi, have no wish to suddenly vanish from Pacham with you. As for me, I would be delighted if you Farcast us somewhere else.
He waited. Aenea said nothing. She did not move. Counselor Albedo smiled again.
We know that you're the only one who has learned how to do this type of Farcasting, he said softly. None of your so-called disciples are close to learning the technique. But what is the technique? The only way we've managed to use the void for forecasting is by wedging open permanent rifts in the medium, and that takes far too much energy.
And they don't allow you to do that anymore, muttered Anea, blinking away the red dots so she could meet the gray man's gaze. The pain from her hand rose and fell in and around her like long swells on an uneasy sea. Counselor Albedo's eyebrow moved up a fraction.
They won't allow us to? Who is they, child? Describe your masters to us.
No masters, murmured Anea. She had to concentrate in order to banish the dizziness. Lions and tigers and bears, she whispered.
No more double talk, rumbled Lord Usami.
The fat man nodded to the second Nemes clone, who walked to the tray, removed the rusty pair of pliers, walked around to Anea's left hand, held it steady at the wrist, and pulled out all of my darling's fingernails. Anea screamed, passed out briefly, awoke, tried to turn her head away in time but failed, vomited on herself, and moaned softly.
There is no dignity in pain, my child, said Cardinal Mustafa. Tell us what the counselor wishes to know, and we will end this sad charade. You will be taken from here, your wounds will be attended to, your finger regrown, you will be cleaned and dressed and reunited with your bodyguard or disciple or whatever. This ugly episode will be over. At that moment, reeling in agony, Anea's body still was aware of the alien substance that had been injected into her while she was unconscious hours earlier. Her cells recognized it. Poison. A sure, slow, terminal poison with no antidote. It would activate in 24 hours, no matter what anyone did. She knew then what they wanted her to do and why. Anea had always been in contact with the Corps, even before she was born, via the Shrone loop in her mother's skull, linked to her father's cybered persona. It allowed her to touch primitive data spheres directly, and she did this now, sensing the solid array of exotic Corps machinery that lined this subterranean cell. Instruments within instruments, sensors beyond human understanding or description, devices working in four dimensions and more, waiting, sniffing, waiting. The Cardinals and Counselor Albedo and the Corps wanted her to escape. Everything was predicated upon her casting out of this intolerable situation. Thus the hollow drama coarseness of the torture, the melodramatic absurdity of the dungeon cell in Castel Sant'Angelo, and the heavy-handed Inquisition. They would hurt her until she could not stand it any longer, and when she cast away, the core instruments would measure everything to the billionth of a nanosecond, analyze her use of the void, and come up with a way to replicate it. The core would finally have their forecasters back, not in their crude wormhole or Gideon drive manner, but instant and elegant and eternally theirs. Anea ignored the Grand Inquisitor, licked her dry, cracked lips, and said distinctly to Counselor Albedo,
I know where you live.
The handsome gray man's mouth twitched.
What do you mean?
I know where the core, the physical elements of the core are, said Anea. Albedo smiled, but Anea saw the quick glance toward the two cardinals and tall priest.
Nonsense, he said. No human being has ever known the location of the core.
In the beginning, said Anea, her voice slurred only slightly by pain and shock. The core was a transient entity floating in the crude datasphere on old Earth known as the Internet. Then, even before the Hegira, you moved your bubble memories and servers and core storage nexus to a cluster of asteroids in long orbit around the sun, far from the old Earth you planned to destroy.
Silence her, snapped Albedo, turning back toward Lurdusami, Mustafa, and Odie. She is trying to distract us from our questioning. This is not important.
The expressions of the Mustafa, Lurdusami, and Odie Hollows suggested otherwise.
during the days of the hegemony, continued Aenea, her good eyelid fluttering with the effort to focus her attention and steady her voice through the long, slow swells of pain. The Corps decided that it was prudent to diversify the physical Corps components. Bubble memory matrices deep underground on the 9 labyrinthine worlds, Fatline servers in the orbital industrial complexes around Tau Ceti Center, core entity personae traveling along Farcaster combands, and the megasphere connecting it all laced through the Farcaster rifts in the void which binds. Albedo folded his arms. You're raving. But after the fall, continued Aenea, holding her good eyelid open and defying the gray man with her stare. The Corps got worried. Mayna Gladstone's attack on the Farcaster medium gave you pause, even if the damage to your megasphere was repairable. You decided to diversify further, multiply your personae, miniaturize essential Corps memories, and make your parasitism on the human neural networks more direct. Albedo turned his back on her and gestured toward the nearest Nemes thing. She's raving, sew her lips shut.
No,
commanded Cardinal Lourdesami. The fat man's eyes were bright and attentive.
Don't touch her until I command it.
The Nemes on Aenea's right had already picked up a needle and roll of heavy thread. Now the pale-faced female paused and looked to Albedo for instructions. Wait, said the counselor. You wanted your neural parasitism to be more direct, said Aenea. So your billions of core entities each formed its surrounding matrix in cruciform shape and attached themselves directly to your human hosts. Every one of your core individuals now has a human host of its own to live in and destroy at will. You remain connected via the old dataspheres and new Gideon Drive megasphere nodes, but you enjoy dwelling so close to your food source. Albedo threw his head back and laughed, showing perfect teeth. He opened his arms and turned back to the 3 human hollows. This is marvelous entertainment, he said, still chuckling. You've arranged all this for her interrogation. He flicked manicured nails in the general direction of the dungeon chamber, the skylight, the iron crossbeams upon which Aenea was clamped. And the girl ends up playing with your minds. Pure nonsense, but wonderfully entertaining. Cardinal Mustafa, Cardinal Lourdesami, and Monsignor Odi were looking at Counselor Albedo most attentively, but their holographic fingers were touching their holographic chests. The red-robed hollow of Lourdesami rose from its invisible chair and walked over to the edge of the grate. The holographic illusion was so perfect that Aenea could hear the slight rustling of the pectoral cross as it swung from its cord of red silk. The cord was intertwined with gold thread and ended in a large red and gold tuft. Aenea concentrated on watching the swinging cross and its clean silk cord, rather than paying attention to the agony in her mutilated hands. She could feel the poison quietly spreading its way through her limbs and torso, like the tumors and nematodes of a growing cruciform. She smiled. Whatever else they did to her, the cells of her body and blood would never accept the cruciform.
"This is interesting but irrelevant, my child," murmured Cardinal Lourdesami. "And this?"
He flicked his short, fat fingers in the direction of her wounds and nakedness as if repulsed by it.
"Is most unpleasant."
The hollow leaned closer, and his intelligent little pig eyes bored into her.
"And most unnecessary. Tell the counselor what he wishes to know."
Aenea raised her head to look into the big man's eyes. "How to cast without a Farcaster?" Cardinal Lourdesami licked his thin lips.
"Yes, yes."
Aenea smiled. "It is simple, Your Eminence. All you have to do is come to a few classes, learn about learning, the language of the dead, of the living, how to hear the music of the spheres, and then take communion with my blood or the blood of one of my followers who has drunk the wine.
Lord Asami backed away as if slapped. He raised the pectoral cross and held it in front of him like a shield.
"Blasphemy!" he bellowed. "Jesus Christus est primogenitus mortuorum. Ipsi gloria et imperium in secula seculorum."
"Jesus Christ was the firstborn of the dead," Aeneas said softly, the reflected light from the cross glaring in her good eye. "And you should offer him glory and dominion if you choose. But it was never his intention that human beings should be revived from death like laboratory mice at the whim of thinking machines."
"Nemes," snapped Counselor Albedo, and this time there was no countermand.
The Nemes female near the wall walked over to the grate, extended 5-centimeter nails, and raked them down Aeneas' cheeks from just under each eye, slicing through muscle and exposing my dear friend's cheekbones to the harsh light. Aeneas let out a long, terrible sigh and slumped back against the girder. Nemes moved her face closer and showed her small, sharp teeth in a wide grin. Her breath was carrion.
"Chew off her nose and eyelids," said Albedo, slowly.
"No,"
shouted Mustafa, leaping to his feet, hurrying forward and reaching out to stop Nemes. His holographic hands passed through Nemes's all-too-solid flesh.
"A moment," said Counselor Albedo, holding up one finger.
Nemes paused with her mouth open above Aeneas' eyes.
"This is monstrous," said the Grand Inquisitor, "as was your treatment of me."
Albedo shrugged. "It was decided that you needed a lesson, Your Eminence." Mustafa was quivering with outrage.
"Do you truly believe you are our masters?"
Counselor Albedo sighed.
"We have always been your masters. You are rotting flesh, wrapped around chimpanzee brains, gibbering primates, decaying toward death from the moment of your birth. Your only role in the universe was as midwives to a higher form of self-awareness, a truly immortal life form."
"The core,"
said Cardinal Mustafa with great disdain.
"Move aside," ordered Counselor Albedo. "Or..."
"Or what?" The Grand Inquisitor laughed. "Or you will torture me as you are torturing this deluded woman? Or you will have your monster beat me unto death again?"
Mustafa swung his holographic arm back and forth through Nemes's tense torso, then through Albedo's hard form. The Grand Inquisitor laughed and turned toward Aeneas.
"You are dead anyway, child. Tell this soulless creature what it needs to know, and we will put you out of your misery in seconds with no—"
"Silence!" shouted Albedo and held up one hand like a curled claw.
The hollow of Cardinal Mustafa screamed, clutched its chest, rolled across the grate through Aeneas' bleeding feet and the iron girder, rolled through one of the Nemes's legs, screamed again and winked out of existence. Cardinal Lourdesami and Monsignor Odi looked at Albedo. Their faces were expressionless.
"Counselor," said the Secretary of State, in a soft, respectful tone, "could I interrogate her for a moment? If we are not successful, you can do what you wish with her."
Albedo stared coolly at the Cardinal, but after a second he clapped Nemes on her shoulder, and the killing thing stepped back 3 paces and closed her wide mouth. Lord Asami reached toward Aeneas' mutilated right hand as if to hold it. His holographic fingers seemed to sink into my darling's torn flesh.
"Quod petis," whispered the Cardinal.
And 10 light minutes away, screaming and writhing in my high-G tank, I understood him through Aeneas.
"What do you seek?"
"Virtutes," whispered Aeneas. "Concede mihi virtutes. Quibus indigio, valeum impere." And drowning in fury and sorrow and the sloshing fluids of my high-G tank, accelerating farther from Aeneas every second, I understood. Strength. That I be given the strength I need to carry out this, my resolve.
"Desiderium tuum grave est,"
whispered Cardinal Lourdesami.
Your desire is a serious one.
Quod ultra queris?
What else do you seek?
Anea blinked blood out of her good eye so that she could see the cardinal's face.
Quero togam pacem,
she said softly, her voice firm.
I seek peace.
Counselor Albedo laughed again.
Your Eminence, he said, his voice sarcastic. Do you think that I do not understand Latin?
Lord Asami looked in the direction of the gray man.
On the contrary, Counselor, I was sure that you did. She is near breaking, you know. I see it in her face. But it is the flames she fears most, not the animal to which you are feeding her.
Albedo looked skeptical.
Give me 5 minutes with the flames, Counselor, said the Cardinal. If that fails, turn your beast loose again.
3 minutes, said Albedo, stepping back next to the Nemes that had raked furrows into Aenea's face.
Lord Usami stepped back several paces. Child, he said, speaking Webb English again. This will hurt very much, I am afraid.
He moved his holographic hands, and a jet of blue flame beneath the grate spurted into a column of flame that singed the bare soles of Aenea's clamped feet. Skin burned, blackened, and curled. The stench of burning flesh filled the cell. Aenea screamed and attempted to pull free of the clamps. They did not budge. The hanging bar of iron on which she was pinned began to glow at the bottom, sending pain up her bare calves and thighs. She felt her skin blister there as well. She screamed again. Cardinal Lord Asami waved his hand again, and the flame dropped back beneath the grate, becoming a pilot light watching like the blue eye of a hungry carnivore.
That is just a taste of the pain you will feel, murmured the Cardinal. And unfortunately, when one is seriously burned, the pain continues, even after the flesh and nerves are irreparably burned away. They say it is the most painful way to die.
Aenea gritted her teeth to keep from screaming again. Blood dripped from her torn cheeks to her pale breasts. Those breasts I had held and kissed and fallen asleep against. Imprisoned in my high-G creche, millions of kilometers away and preparing to spin up to C-plus and fugue oblivion, I screamed and raged into silence. Albedo stepped onto the grate and said to my dear friend,
"Cast away from all this. Cast to the ship that is taking Rawl to certain death and free him. Cast to the consul's ship. The auto-surgeon there will heal you. You will live for years with the man you love. It is either that, or a slow and terrible death here for you, and a slow and terrible death for Rawl elsewhere. You will never see him again, never hear his voice. Cast away, Aenea, save yourself while there is still time. Save the one you love. In a minute, this man will burn the flesh from your legs and arms until your bones blacken. But we will not let you die. I will turn Nemes loose to feed on you. Cast away, Aenea, cast away now.
Aenea, said Cardinal Lord Usami, est igitur paratus. Are you ready, therefore?
In nomine humanitus, ego paratusum, said Aenea, looking into the cardinal's eyes with her one good eye. In the name of humanitus, I am ready.
Cardinal Lord Usami waved his hand. All of the gas jets flamed high at once. Flame engulfed my darling and the Albedo Cybrid. Aenea stretched in agony as the heat engulfed her.
No! Screamed Albedo from the midst of flames and walked from the burning grate, his synthetic flesh burning away from his false bones. His expensive gray clothes rose toward the distant ceiling in burning wads of cloth, and his handsome features were melting onto his chest.
No, damn you!
He screamed again and reached for Lord Asami's throat with blazing fingers. Albedo's hands went through the hologram. The cardinal was staring at Aenea's face through the flames. He raised his right hand.
Misericordium Dei, in nomine Patris et Filia
et Spiritus Sanctus.
These were the last words that Aenea ever heard, as the flames closed on her ears and throat and face. Her hair exploded in flame. Her vision burned a bright orange and faded as her eyes were fused with flames. But I felt her pain in the few seconds of life left to her, and I heard her thoughts like a shout, no, like a whisper in my mind. "Rahl, I love you." Then the heat expanded, the pain expanded, her sense of life and love and mission expanded and lifted through the flames like smoke rising toward the unseen ceiling skylight, and my darling Aenea died. I felt the second of her death, like an implosion of all sight and sound and symbol essence. Everything in the universe worth loving and living for disappeared at that second. I did not scream again. I quit pounding the walls of my high-G tank. I floated in weightlessness, feeling the tank drain, feeling the drugs and umbilicals for cryogenic fugue fall into me and onto me like worms at my flesh. I did not fight. I did not care. Aenea was dead. The torchip translated to quantum state. When I awoke, I was in this Schrodinger cat box death cell. It did not matter. Aenea was dead.
Chapter 32. There was neither clock nor calendar in my cell. I do not know how many standard days, weeks, or months I was beyond the reach of sanity. I may have gone many days without sleeping, or slept for weeks on end. It is difficult or impossible to tell. But eventually, when the cyanide and the laws of quantum chance continued to spare me from day to day, hour to hour, minute to minute, I began this narrative. I do not know why my imprisoners provided me with a slate text scriber and stylus and the ability to print a few pages of recycled microvellum. Perhaps they saw the possibility of the condemned man writing his confession, or using the scriber stylus as an impotent way to rage at his judges and jailers. Or perhaps they saw the condemned man's writing of his sins and injuries, joys and losses of joy, as an additional source of punishment. And perhaps, in a way, it was. But it was also my salvation. At first, it saved me from the insanity and self-destruction of uncontrollable grief and remorse. Then it saved my memories of Aenea, pulling them from the quagmire of horror at her terrible death, to the firmer ground of our days together, her joy of living, her mission, our travels, and her complex but terribly straightforward message to me and all humankind. Eventually, it simply saved my life. Soon after beginning the narrative, I discovered that I could share the thoughts and actions of any of the participants in our long odyssey and failed struggle. I knew that this was a function of what Aenea had taught me through discussion and communion, with learning the language of the dead and the language of the living. I still encountered the dead in my sleeping and waking dreams. My mother often spoke to me, and I tasted the agony and wisdom of uncounted others who had lived and died long ago. But it was not these lost souls who obsessed me now. It was those with some parallel view of my own experiences in all my years of knowing Aenea. Never during my time waiting for death in the Schrodinger cat box did I believe that I could hear the current thoughts of the living beyond my prison. I assumed that the fused energy shell of the orbital egg somehow prevented that. But I soon learned how to shut out the clamor of all those countless older voices resonating in the void which binds, and concentrate on the memories of those dead as well as presumably still living, who had been part of Aenea's story. Thus I entered into at least some of the thoughts and motives of human beings so different from my own way of thinking as to be literally alien creatures. Cardinals Simon Agostino Lourdesami and John Domenico Mustafa,
Lenar Hoyt in his incarnations as Pope Julius and Pope Urban XVI. Mercantilist traders such as Kenzo Isozaki and Anna Pelli Cognani. Priests and warriors such as Father DeSoya, Sergeant Gregorius, Captain Margaret Wu, and Executive Officer Hogan Leibler. Some of the characters in my tale are present in the void which binds, largely as scars, holes, vacancies. The Nemes creatures are such vacuums, as are Counselor Albedo and the other core entities. But I was able to track some of the movements and actions of these beings simply by the movement of that vacancy through the matrix of sentient emotion that was the void, much as one would see the outline of an invisible man in a hard rain. Thus, in combination with listening to the soft murmurings of the human dead, I could reconstruct Radamanth Nemes's slaughter of the innocents on Sol Draconi Septim, and hear the sibilant hissings and see the deadly actions of Scylla, Gyges, Briareus, and Nemes on Vitus Grey Balianus B. But as distasteful and disorienting as these descents into moral vacuum and mental nightmare were to me, they were balanced by a taste again of the warmth of such friends as Demloa, Demria, Father Glaucus, Hetmastine, Abetic, and all the rest. Many of these participants in the tale I sought out only through my own memory. Wonderful people such as Lomo Dondrub, last seen flying off on his wings of pure light in his gallant and hopeless battle against the Pax warships, and Rachel, living the second of several lives she was destined to fill with adventure, and the regal Dorji Famo and the wise young Dalai Lama. In this way, I was using the void which binds to hear my own voice, to clarify memory beyond the ability and clarity of memory. And in that sense, I often saw myself as a minor character in my own tale, a not-too-intelligent follower, usually reacting rather than leading, often failing to ask questions when he should, or accepting answers all too inadequate. But I also saw the lumbering Rol Endymion of the tale, as a man discovering love with a person he had waited for all of his life. And in that sense, his willingness to follow without question was often balanced by his willingness to give his life in an instant for his dear friend. Although I know without doubt that Anea is dead, I never sought her voice among the chorus of those speaking the language of the dead. Rather, I felt her presence throughout the void which binds, felt her touch in the minds and hearts of all the good people who wandered through our odyssey, or had their lives changed forever in our long struggle with the Pax. As I learned to dim the insensate clamor and pick out specific voices among the chorus of the dead, I realized that I often visualized these human resonances in the void as stars. Some dim but visible when one knew where to look, others blazing like supernovas, still others existing in binary combinations with other former living souls, or set forever in a constellation of love and relationship with specific individuals. Others, like Mustafa and Lourdes Sami and Hoyt, all but burned out and imploded by the terrible gravity of their ambition or greed or lust for power. Their human radiance all but lost as they collapsed into black holes of the spirit. But Anea was not one of these stars. She was like the sunlight that had surrounded us during a walk on a warming spring day in the meadows above Taliesin West. Constant, diffuse, flowing from a single source, but warming everything and everyone around us. A source of life and energy. And as when winter comes or night falls, the absence of that sunlight brings the cold and darkness, and we wait for spring and morning. But I knew that there would be no morning for Anea now, no resurrection for her and our love affair. The great power of her message is that the Pax's version of resurrection was a lie, as sterile as the required birth control injections administered by the Pax. In a finite universe of would-be immortals, there is almost no room for children. The Pax universe was ordered and static, unchanging and sterile.
Children bring chaos and clutter, and an infinite potential for the future that was anathema to the Pax. As I thought of this, and pondered Ania's last gift to me, the antidote to the Pax birth control implant within me, I wondered if it had been a primarily metaphorical gesture. I hoped that Ania had not been suggesting that I use it literally, that I find another love, a wife, have children with someone else. In one of our many conversations, she and I had discussed that once. I remember it was while sitting in the vestibule of her shelter near Taliesin, as the evening wind blew the scent of yucca and primrose to us. That strange elasticity of the human heart in finding new relationships, new people to share one's life with, new potentials. But I hoped that Aeneas' gift of fertility in that last few minutes we were together in St. Peter's Basilica was a metaphor for the wider gift she had already given humanity. The option for chaos and clutter and wonderful unseen options. If it was a literal gift, a suggestion that I find a new love, have children with someone else, then Ania had not known me at all. In my writing of this narrative, I had seen all too well through the eyes of too many others that Roland Dimion was a likable enough fellow, trustworthy, awkwardly valiant on occasion, but not known for his insight or intelligence. But I was smart enough and insightful enough, at least into my own soul, to know for certain that this one love had been enough for my lifetime. And while I grew to realize, as the days and weeks and then almost certainly months passed in my death cell with no arrival of death, that if I somehow miraculously returned to the universe of the living, I would seek out joy and laughter and friendship again, but not a pale shadow of the love I had felt. Not children. No. For a few wonderful days while writing the text, I convinced myself that Ania had returned from the dead, that some sort of miracle had been possible. I had just reached the part of my narrative where we had reached old Earth, passing through the Farcaster on God's Grove after the terrible encounter with the first Nemes thing, and had finished that section with a description of our arrival at Taliesin West. The night after finishing that first chunk of our story, I dreamed that Ania had come to me there, in the Schrödinger death cell, had called my name in the dark, touched my cheek, and whispered to me, "We're leaving here, Rol, my darling. Not soon, but as soon as you finish your tale, as soon as you remember it all and understand it all." When I awoke, I had found that the stylus scriber had been activated, and on its pages, in Ania's distinctive handwriting, was a long note from her, including some excerpts from her father's poetry. For days, weeks, I was convinced that this had been a real visitation, a miracle of the sort the later apostles had insisted was visited on the original disciples after Jesus' execution. And I worked on the narrative at a fever pitch, desperate to see it all, record it all, and understand it all. But the process took me more months, and in that time I came to realize that the visit from Ania must have been something else altogether. My first experience of hearing a whisper of her among the voices of the dead in the void almost certainly, and possibly somehow, an actual message from her stored in the memory of the scriber and set to be triggered when I wrote those pages. It was not beyond possibility. One thing that had been certain was my darling friend's ability to catch glimpses of the future. Futures, she always said, emphasizing the plural. It might have been possible for her to store that beautiful note in a scriber, and somehow see to it that the instrument was included in my Schrödinger cat box cell. Or, and this is the explanation I have come to accept, I wrote that note myself while totally immersed, although possessed might be a better word, in Ania's persona as I pursued its essence through the void and my own memories. This theory is the least pleasing to me, but it conforms with Ania's only expressed view of the afterlife, based as it was more or less on the Judaic tradition of believing that people live on after death only in the hearts and memories of those they loved, and those they served, and those they saved. At any rate, I wrote for more months, began to see the true immensity and futility of Aenea's brave quest and hopeless sacrifice. And then I finished the frenzied scribbling, found the courage to describe Aenea's terrible death and my own helplessness as she died, wept as I printed out the last few pages of microvellum, read them, recycled them, ordered the scriber to keep the complete narrative in its memory, and shut the stylus off for what I thought was the final time. Aenea did not appear. She did not lead me out of captivity. She was dead. I felt her absence from the universe as clearly as I had felt any resonance from the void which binds since my communion. So I lay in my Schrodinger cat box, tried to sleep, forgot to eat, and waited for death. Some of my explorations among the voices of the dead had led to revelations that had no direct relevance to my narrative. Some were personal and private, waking dreams of my long-dead father hunting with his brothers, for instance, and an insight into the generosity of that quiet man I had never known, or chronicles of human cruelty that, like the memories of Jacob Shulman from the forgotten 20th century, acted only as subtext for my deeper understanding of today's barbarisms. But other voices. So I had finished the narrative of my life with Aenea and was waiting to die, spending longer and longer sleep periods, hoping that the decisive quantum event would occur while I was asleep, aware of the text in the memory of my scriber, and wondering vaguely if anyone would ever figure out a way through the fix to explode if tampered with shell of my Schrodinger box, and find my narrative someday, perhaps centuries hence, when I fell asleep again and had this dream. I knew at once that this was not a regular dream, that wavefront dance of possibilities, but was a call from one of the voices of the dead. In my dream, the hegemony consul was playing the Steinway on the balcony of his ebony spaceship, that spaceship that I knew so well, while great green saurian things surged and bellowed in the nearby swamps. He was playing Schubert. I did not recognize the world beyond the balcony, but it was a place of huge primitive plants, towering storm clouds, and frightening animal roars. The consul was a smaller man than I had always imagined. When he was finished with the piece, he sat quietly for a moment in the twilight, until the ship spoke in a voice I did not recognize, a smarter, more human voice. "Very nice," said the ship. "Very nice indeed." "Thank you, John," said the consul, rising from the bench and bringing the balcony into the ship with him. It was beginning to rain. "Do you still insist on going hunting in the morning?" asked the disembodied voice that was not the ship's as I knew it. "Yes," said the consul. "It is something I do here upon occasion." "Do you like the taste of dinosaur meat?" asked the ship's AI. "Not at all," said the consul. "Almost inedible. It is the hunt I enjoy." "You mean the risk," said the ship. "That too," the consul chuckled, "although I do take care." "But what if you don't come back from your hunt tomorrow?" asked the ship. His voice was of a young man with an old earth British accent. The consul shrugged. "We've spent, what, more than 6 years exploring the old hegemony worlds. We know the pattern. Chaos, civil war, starvation, fragmentation. We've seen the fruit of the fall of the Farcaster system." "Do you think that Gladstone was wrong in ordering the attack?" asked the ship softly. The consul had poured himself a brandy at the sideboard, and now carried it to the chess table set near the bookcase. He took a seat and looked at the game pieces already engaged in battle on the board in front of him. "Not at all," he said. "She did the right thing. But the result is sad. It will be decades, perhaps centuries, before the web begins to weave itself together in a new form." He had been warming the brandy and sloshing it gently as he spoke. Now he inhaled it and sipped. Looking up, the consul said, "Would you like to join me for the completion of our game, John?" The hollow of a young man appeared in the seat opposite. He was a striking young man with clear hazel-colored eyes, low brow, hollow cheeks, a compact nose and stubborn jaw, and a wide mouth that suggested both a calm masculinity and a hint of pugnaciousness. The young man was dressed in a loose blouse and high-cut breeches. His hair was auburn-colored, thick and very curly. The consul knew that his guest had once been described as having a brisk, winning face, and he put that down to the easy mobility of expression that came with the young man's great intelligence and vitality. "Your move," said John. The consul studied his options for several moments and then moved a bishop. John responded at once, pointing to a pawn that the consul obediently moved one rank forward for him. The young man looked up with sincere curiosity in his eyes. "What if you don't come back from the hunt tomorrow?" he said softly. Startled out of his reverie, the consul smiled. "Then the ship is yours, which it obviously is anyway." He moved his bishop back. "What will you do, John, if this should be the end of our travels together?" John gestured to have his rook moved forward at the same lightning speed with which he replied. "Take it back to Hyperion," he said. "Program it to return to Braun if all is well, or possibly to Martin Silenus, if the old man is still alive and working on his contos." "Program it?" said the consul, frowning at the board. "You mean you'd leave the ship's AI?" He moved his bishop diagonally another square. "Yes," said John, pointing to have his pawn advanced again. "I will do that in the next few days at any rate." His frown deepening, the consul looked at the board, then at the hologram across from him, and then at the board again. "Where will you go?" he said, and moved his queen to protect his king. "Back into the core," said John, moving the rook two spaces. "To confront your maker again?" asked the consul, attacking again with his bishop. John shook his head. His bearing was very upright, and he had the habit of clearing his forehead of curls with an elegant backward toss of his head. "No," he said softly. "To start raising hell with the core entities. To accelerate their endless civil wars and internecine rivalries. To be what my template had been to the poetic community, an irritant." He pointed to where he wanted his remaining knight moved. The consul considered that move, found it not a threat, and frowned at his own bishop. "For what reason?" he said at last. John smiled again and pointed to the square where his rook should next appear. "My daughter will need the help in a few years," he said. He chuckled. "Well, in 270-some years, actually." "Checkmate." "What?" said the consul, startled, and studied the board. "It can't be." John waited. "Damn," said the hegemony consul at last, tipping over his king. "God damn and spit in hell." "Yes," said John, extending his hand. "Thank you again for a pleasant game, and I do hope that tomorrow's hunt turns out more agreeably for you." "Damn," said the consul, and without thinking, attempted to shake the hologram's thin-fingered hand. For the 100th time, his solid fingers went through the other's insubstantial palm. "Damn," he said again. That night, in the Schrodinger cell, I awoke with two words echoing in my mind. The child. The knowledge that Ania had been married before our relationship had become a full-fledged love affair. The knowledge that she had given birth to a child had burned in my soul and gut like a painful ember. But except for my almost obsessive curiosity about who and why, curiosity unsatisfied by my questioning of A. Betic, Rachel, and the others who had seen her leave during her odyssey with them, but who had no idea themselves where she had gone or with whom, I had not considered the reality of that child alive somewhere in the same universe I inhabited. Her child. The thought made me want to weep for several reasons. "The child is nowhere I can find it now," Ania had said. Where might that child be now? How old? I sat on my bunk in the Schrodinger cat box and pondered this. Aenea had just turned 23 standard years old when she died. Correction, when she had been brutally murdered by the Corps and its Pax puppets. She had disappeared from sight for the 1 year, 11 months, 1 week, and 6 hours when she had just turned 20 years old. That would make the infant about 3 standard years old, plus the time I had spent here in the Schrodinger execution egg, 8 months, 10. I simply did not know, but if the child were still alive, he or she... My God, I had never asked Aenea whether her baby had been a boy or girl, and she had not mentioned it the one time she had discussed the matter with me. I had been so involved with my own hurt and childish sense of injustice that I had not thought to ask her. What an idiot I had been. The child, Aenea's son or Aenea's daughter, would now be about 4 standard years old. Walking, certainly. Talking, yes. My God, I realized. Her child would be a rational human being at this point, talking, asking questions. A lot of questions, if my few experiences with young children were any indication. Learning to hike and fish and to love nature. I had never asked Aenea her child's name. My eyes burned and my throat closed with the painful recognition of this fact. Again, she had shown no inclination to talk about that period in her life, and I had not asked, telling myself in the weeks we had had together afterward that I did not want to upset her with questions or probings that would make her feel guilty and make me feel murderous. But Aenea had shown no guilt when she had briefly told me about her marriage and child. To be honest, that is part of the reason I'd felt so furious and helpless at the knowledge. But somehow, incredibly, it had not stopped us from being lovers. How had it been phrased on the note I had found on my stylus screen months ago? The note I was sure was from Aenea. Lovers of whom the poets would sing. That was it. The knowledge of her brief marriage and the child had not stopped us from feeling toward one another like lovers who had never experienced such emotion with another person. And perhaps she had not, I realized. I had always assumed that her marriage was one of sudden passion, almost impulse. But now I looked at it in another way. Who was the father? Aenea's note had said that she loved me backward and forward in time, which is precisely the way I had discovered I felt about her. It was as if I had always loved her, had waited my entire life to discover the reality of that love. What if Aenea's marriage had not been one of love or passion or impulse, but convenience? No, not the right word. Necessity? It had been prophesied by the Templars, the Austers, the Shrike cult church of the Final Atonement, and others, that Aenea's mother, Braunlamia, would bear a child, the one who teaches, Aenea, as it turned out. According to the old poet's cantos, on the day that the second John Keats Seibert had died a physical death and Braunlamia had fought her way to the Shrike Temple for refuge, the Shrike cultists had chanted, "Blessed be the mother of our salvation, blessed be the instrument of our atonement," the salvation being Aenea herself. What if Aenea had been destined to have a child to continue this line of prophets, of messiahs? I had not heard any of these prophecies of another in Aenea's line. But there was one thing I had discovered beyond argument during my month's writing of Aenea's life. Rol Endymion was slow and thick-witted, usually the last to understand anything. Perhaps there had been as many prophecies of another one who teaches as there had been preceding Aenea herself. Or perhaps this child would have completely different powers.